Good morning, and may it please the court. I truly believe that the court below does not understand Title VII hostile environment law. This is the second time we're up here again after the court below, after a bench trial, made 51 specific findings, as we have outlined in our appellate brief, of specific instances of misconduct which the court below characterized as being harsh or abusive, but not severe or pervasive. These are 51 separate acts of misconduct which occurred over a period of time of approximately 1 year.
I take it that these findings in the second order were intended to be supplemental to and not in lieu of the findings made before?
Your Honor, indeed, the court at page 31, note 8 of its opinion, and therefore at page 31 of our short appendix, stated specifically in that footnote, this court now incorporates its findings of fact in its January 5th, 2001 memorandum of decision. So indeed, the one which is the immediate proximate cause of her being here, was intended to be supplemental and not in lieu of. Your Honor will recall, perhaps Your Honor won't recall, but in any event, last time around, no one appealed the court's findings of fact. I appealed its conclusions of law. Mr. Bauman did not appeal the court's findings of fact.
Either conclusions of law or findings of fact.
I beg your pardon, sir?
One appeals from judgments, not from findings of fact or conclusions of law.
I thank Your Honor for the correction. What I intended to convey is that no one challenged the court's findings of fact in this court, either the first time round or indeed now.
But there's some contradiction. I mean, I remember, of course, that that's what the court said, but in fact, the second set of findings say some things that are inconsistent with the first set of findings.
Well, indeed they are, Your Honor, and I think this is a part of the sort of, I think, the confusion in which the district court finds itself. For instance, at one point it finds that specific supervisors found, or rather used certain epithets, and then later says, well, the evidence didn't use the word speculative, I can't recall the exact word that it used. I agree with Your Honor that there seems to be some tremendous confusion on the part of the court below, but I think that the critical statement is indeed in that footnote where the court is saying, look, I'm not reexamining the facts, I'm finding more facts. Now, the problem with the court's decision and why I say, and I understand what I'm saying, and I say it with due respect to the court below, that it doesn't understand the law of Title VII is because, I mean, you look at towards the end of the court's opinion with respect to the prima facie case. And what it says is, there's just a sort of a phrase that the court throws out, and this is at page 44 of the opinion in the short appendix, it says, well, even considering the conduct cumulatively, as though the court is now going out of its way to sort of consider the conduct cumulatively. Well, indeed, it was obligated to consider the conduct cumulatively. That is what this court's first opinion says. That's what Title VII law has been since before I became a lawyer, it is the totality of the circumstances. And indeed, one of the things that the court did again in the second opinion was to balkanize the case.
But I guess one of the things that concerns me a little bit more than cumulative versus individual, at some point you have to talk about individual things, but the court says that the reason that the plaintiff hasn't shown that there was a hostile environment is because the plaintiff didn't show that the supervisors played any role in the writing or speaking of the more severe terms. And I'm a little worried that this confuses the element of discrimination here in the form of hostile environment with the element of vicarious liability. I mean, anybody could have written the graffiti. It doesn't matter if it's the supervisors or anyone else. If we want to know, then the question is what happens next.
That's right, Your Honor. The point is that I mean, it really doesn't matter. The question then becomes, well, did the employer know about the graffiti, for instance? The court took the graffiti to be, the more serious form of whatever, discrimination, however you want to characterize it, the more severe misconduct. Mm-hmm. And I think the court indeed was led itself astray by saying, well, we don't know that supervisors did it, and we didn't attempt to prove. I have no idea who wrote the graffiti on the wall. There was some suggestion that it was used, that it was a particular marker that supervisors tended to use, but I certainly did not take on the burden of proving what individual wrote it. The point is that it was ubiquitous. And the point is that the employer knew about it because the employer, from time to time, would paint over the graffiti until the general manager testified it got so bad that he just put up a chalkboard, hoping that people would use the chalkboard because it's easier to erase the chalk, I presume, than it is to paint over the graffiti. I mean, truly, I am at a loss here to explain to a client how it is that every fact to which he testified, and there were 51 of them, was found by the court to have in fact occurred over a period of a year, while the ardent denial of the defendant that any of this misconduct took place was different, was not found, and I'm sorry, I realize I'm not in front of a jury, that I'm a trial lawyer, though I'm not really an appellate lawyer, the district court then found the denials of the defendants, and each of them, not to be credible, and yet throws in a sentence in its second conclusions of law saying, well, this is not, no preponderance of evidence that this was objectively hostile. My client's being called a spick and a wetback by his supervisors, and the court so found. What do I have to do to prove,
From an appellate lawyer's point of view, focus for us, exactly what you want, what you think should happen now, the key legal errors that the district court made, or if this is more a situation where now that the record's become confused with conflicting facts, whether we need to send this back to have those clarified once again, what exactly needs to happen in your view? Obviously, we'll hear
from you. You mean in terms of remedy?
Yeah. What are the key problems, and what's the remedy?
Well, I think we're back to where we were the first appeal, which is that there are certain findings of fact which the court made. Those findings compel a result. And the key legal issues here, it seems to me, are even assuming, one of the things the court says is, well, I don't know how many times he was called a spick and a wetback. Okay. And Mr. Cyrus wasn't sure, and he said it was continuous. But having made 51 findings, separate findings, over a period of time of approximately a year, we're back where we were the first time in the remedy I sought in the first appeal, which is that these facts compel a result under Title VII law as it exists, and that result is a judgment in the favor of Mr. Cyrus.
Before you leap from a violation to a judgment, you might want to discuss the Ellert defense.
Yes, sir, and that is clearly something that I need to. But the judge asked me, Judge Wood asked me what remedy I wanted, and that's a remedy. In any event, the Ellert defense, let me spend some time on that. The court here again is in contradiction with itself, because on the one hand, it stated, that the plaintiff brought the misconduct and some of the incidents to the attention of the defendant's agents, and on the which of course also goes to the employer's liability, by the way, and then also states that Mr. Cyrus did absolutely nothing to take advantage of, as the court misstated the nature of this case, the sexual harassment policy of the defendant. In fact, as we've shown in our brief, there are three different policies and three different reporting policies, and Mr. Cyrus complied with each of them, including ultimately bringing the matter to the attention of Mr. Bauman personally, who was at the time, I think, I can't remember the exact title, but he was manager or vice president of human resources, I'm not sure. Now, the point of the affirmative defense, Your Honor, it seems to me, is not to require the plaintiff to go through some procedural hurdle and then to play a game of aha or gotcha. It is truly to put the defendant on notice so that it can take prompt and remedial measures. And the defense is, had we but known, we would not have allowed these things to happen. Now, in this case, we know that Mr. Bauman conducted an investigation and found that Mr. Siros was lying. They cannot, therefore, it seems to me, as a matter of law, say, but if we had but known, we would have taken prompt or remedial measures, because when they did know, Mr. Bauman's testimony, incidentally, being that he interviewed all those witnesses, only the supervisors. He didn't interview any of the witnesses that Mr. Siros said would back him up, two of whom testified at trial. He found Siros was lying. Now, if these incidents didn't happen, which was Mr. Bauman's defense at trial, he also served as one of the defense counsel below, how is it that Mr. Siros' alleged unreasonable failure to report could have contributed to a failure or the inability on the part of the defendant to take prompt or remedial measures? I hope to spend a little more time on that in my rebuttal time. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, counsel. Mr. Bauman.
Please the court. John Bauman representing Steel Technologies. I'd like to direct the court's attention to several recently decided Seventh Circuit opinions. The first is Cohen Development versus JMJ Properties, holding in relevant part, because the district court rendered judgment after bench trial, we review its application of facts to law for clear error.
We know that standard, of course, quite well, but I guess the problem that I have here, maybe you can offer some opinions, is when the district court makes findings of fact after a bench trial, when one contradicts another, we have, of course, a possibility of trying to construe them in some way that's consistent. But if there really is a contradiction, it's a little hard to know to which fact do you give clear error deference. And here, the earlier sets of facts, particularly on some of these crucial points about the Ehlers defense, to what extent did Mr. Siros report up the chain and so forth, are in, I'll say, substantial tension with one another. And had the district court said something like, I am now setting aside my earlier facts to the extent they are inconsistent with this more thorough look, that would be one thing. But she actually says quite the opposite. And I'm having a lot of trouble making some sense of this record.
I believe what the district court did was assess, and during the post-appellate briefing period, and look back on the credibility of witnesses and make a decision about whether the plaintiff met the burden of production.
Well, I understand that, but the point is, when she says these facts, I'm incorporating my old facts, and then she says things that conflict with the old facts, maybe you're right, but that's not what she said she was doing. She said that she was incorporating the old facts, and these are on such critical points, because just to take the Ehlers defense, there are, of course, as you know, two elements. One, did the person reasonably avail himself of the policy that the employer had in place? And certainly, if there's an investigation, if the higher-ups know, and if the earlier findings of fact indicate reporting to various people in authority, it indicates that the reporting happened. And then the second thing is, were reasonably effective measures taken? And it certainly appears, with respect to the graffiti, that painting it over was a notoriously ineffective step to take. If you have to go down there and repeatedly paint over, you're not doing something that's working.
I think the timeline here is what's critical, that the court has referenced the reporting period. In fact, the plaintiff in this case did not go to Human Resources, and the court found on numerous occasions did not use the 800 number, did not go to Human Resources.
But he reports to a lot of people. I mean, we've said that, I mean, it's fine to have human resources, but most companies are more than happy for reporting to happen to supervisors of supervisors, to human resources. The point is corporate knowledge.
Agreed, but when there's a point person in this case, to reference this, when there's a point person in the of the three policies referenced, they all end up with either vice president of human or human resources. In fact, the one key policy that revolves around other unlawful harassment specifically says, report to your supervisor. If that's not appropriate, or you haven't received a response within a few days, go directly to three named individuals with an 800 number. That never happened. The timeline that Mr. Istabadi references was 14 months after the charge was filed was the first time there was any report made to human resources. So when a policy specifically states a point person and someone doesn't follow the policy, Steel Technologies had no opportunity to go forward and correct it. Now, you referenced the graffiti. What happened was, factually, and it's in the record, is that I wear many hats in this case. I went to as corporate counsel and manager of human resources 10 days before he filed with the EEOC. I went to speak to the employees and go through the policy. We had a policy, first element. We were going through the policy. That's part of the first element as well. We were going through the policy, and at no time was there any reference to racial or national origin epithets. There was a reference to a sexually explicit cartoon or caricature.
But Theros did tell Mr. Bennett that these various offensive epithets were being used with reference to him.
We don't have any idea. One of the biggest problems in this case is the sketchiness of the testimony and the lack of specifics.
Well, I'm saying the district court found that.
Right, but
so
they found
if you
that
want us to find that fact-finding clearly erroneous, you're free to argue that, I suppose, since that would support the judgment also. But the district court did find that the first time around. Then the district court switches ground the second time around and says that plaintiff didn't express concerns about racism before a September 96 meeting.
It's a timeline issue. The graffiti and the references to the graffiti all happened after the charge. Now, should they, as one court referenced, this court doesn't sit in super personnel position
that
over what happened.
Quoted way too often. I mean, you know, we know that, and obviously, believe me, a lot of things that are despicable in workplaces happen, and it's not our problem. But this one is about some very severe statements of a racist nature.
During the trial, we asked the plaintiff, what would you have had us do? What type of investigation would have been done? Could you think of anything? And there was nothing that came up. The point of the matter is, immediately cleaning it over, having these meetings with personnel, which we do every year, and describing the fact that this is inappropriate, making a public show of the removal of the sexual caricature by the corporate counsel and manager of human resources, and everyone being aware that that was happening and this is unacceptable behavior, was the response.
What about interviewing the witnesses that he identified that would have corroborated his account of what was going on?
There bears the problem. He never identified witnesses. He would not talk to us. He went directly from, please report these to HR, to 10 days later going to the EEOC, to when I came up after the EEOC sanctioned me speaking with him, refusal to talk to me, and there was no one to interview. Mr. Istabadi references, you know, my conclusion that he was not telling the truth, and that conclusion came 14 months later in November of 97 when he finally came forward in his attorney's office with the facts, with more details on what was said, because the charge itself only says verbal abuse, and nowhere in the 9-page EEOC affidavit does he mention one circumstance, one slur, one epithet, or graffiti. He goes through painfully 13 different aspects of discrimination, and never in that EEOC affidavit mentions any reference to racist remarks or graffiti. And this happened, you know, at the time the charge was filed under the watchful eye of the EEOC.
people don't normally put all of their evidence. I mean, you knew this was a racial harassment case from the EOC's from the EOC filing. That's the only thing you have to know.
And that's the point. Upon reading verbal racist remarks, I immediately went up there and said, what verbal racist remarks? There's nothing in the record. There's no complaint made. I don't know what you're talking about. Please come and talk to me. And he refused to do so. So I was hampered in my investigation, other than just talking to whoever I could think of to talk to, which was all the supervisors.
Well, you're testifying to us right now. We have a record, and I really am uncomfortable with this line being crossed, because the fact is the district court
there's actually an ethical rule that says that if you have evidentiary information about the case, you should not represent the client. You are not only attempting to testify to us, you are testifying to a violation of a fundamental rule of legal ethics.
I apologize, Your Honor.
It's not a question of apology.
Well, what happened in the court was
I don't want more testimony as a result.
I believe what I've referenced is in the record, and I apologize to the court.
Well, you talk about measures that the company took, and you talk about, you know, wiping out the graffiti and then putting a chalkboard in. How was that supposed to remedy it so that if the remarks continued, it was sort of like an assumption the remarks would continue and then they could be erased? I mean, there was no interview of his co-workers during the course of this, in terms of a thorough investigation.
The chalkboard was meant was not inducing more graffiti of some sort. It was so people could express their opinions. It was not
the chalkboard in the bathroom, so people could. That's where it was placed, right?
But
where all the graffiti was written in the bathroom. I mean, normally in a workplace, if you want to, I would think, get comments from the employees on relevant matters, you would put it in a hallway or place where the employees would pass all the time. Why would the chalkboard be placed in the bathroom where all this graffiti was?
I don't have an answer to that. I wouldn't have done it if given that reference. But I do want to reference a couple of comments to do with the clear error standard. Special deference will be given to the district court's findings upon credibility determinations, and that's what's happened here. The district court found that as to the frequency of remarks by supervisors, to the extent remarks can actually be attributed to supervisors. I think what's important here is the two references you made to the prior opinion. One is supervisors, including Colvin, and other employees occasionally referred to the plaintiff as Brown Boy Spick, Julio, and Javier, talked down to him and said things under their breath. The court was, I think, clarified in a later opinion that the court was not saying every one of these people did every one of these things, but referenced later fact-finding to say there's no, Pellin has not shown by a preponderance of evidence that any supervisor made race or national origin-related remarks.
That doesn't matter. I mean, why isn't it a hostile work environment if his co-workers are using these terms? Then the purpose of the Ehlers defense is to figure out whether this is one of those situations where a supervisor could be held liable or not, depending, you know, obviously if there's a tangible employment action or not, depends, you know, what our standard of liability is. But if all she's trying to say is maybe the supervisors didn't do it, but if he still reported and they were still aware of it, which they obviously are, if they're doing investigations and they're looking into it, the fact that it's a co-employee is enough for liability. I really think the legal standards here have gotten very mixed up, one with the other. Co-employee versus supervisor, supervisor, tangible employment action, no tangible employment action, Burlington Industries against Ehlers Defense, those are all separate elements.
I again go back to the fact that during the time period that these alleged occurrences happened by co-workers.
Well, she finds the occurrences were there. You're not saying that was clearly erroneous, that all of these terms were used and that's what the graffiti said. And I mean, the district court does make those findings a fact.
She does say specifically that other employees occasionally referred to the plaintiff as.
Right.
You're talking about
all these words and the obscene drawing and so on.
I go back to the human resources needed to be informed of the situation. That Cirrus refused to utilize the policy, did not go to human resources, as the court said, utterly failed to follow the procedures in the policy. But the other reference to the court is, the court is convinced that some inappropriate name calling occurred, some national origin epithets were hurled, and some harsher abusive misconduct took place. Again, there's no reference there to supervisors. And although I understand the court not wanting to lump the two together, and they shouldn't be, supervisors should be, are different than coworkers.
Well, if a supervisor done, it's open and shut.
I don't beg you, court's indulgence, I don't think it is open and shut. I don't believe the supervisors did it, but if the supervisors did it, I think you still have the right to depend upon the affirmative defenses.
If there's no tangible employment action.
Right, which
don't
the court
forget that element. Right.
And also, the negligence of the employer. I believe that Cirrus was under an obligation to go to human resources, or at least speak up at the September 96 meeting with Todd Bennett, where he only brought up discrimination and did not bring up these racial remarks. At the October 21st, all in the record, October 21st discrimination talk by myself, where he did not bring up racist remarks, graffiti, or comments by coworkers. After the charge, when I went up there to speak, which is also in the record.
You're still testifying, you know.
But it's in the record.
We should be referring to the district court's findings of fact.
Sorry.
Thank you very much. Mr. Istrabadi.
In fact, Your Honors, the court below found on two separate occasions Mr. Cirrus reported to the general manager, Mr. Bennett. On one of those occasions, the court below found Mr. Bennett laughed at Mr. Cirrus' complaints. Now, the three policies are, one, it's a three-step policy for the employee. My time is limited. He goes up to the general manager. The fourth step of going to corporate is the general manager's obligation, not the employee's. The same general manager, Mr. Bennett, who laughed at Cirrus. The other two policies required Mr. Cirrus, one of them to go to his immediate supervisor, the other one to his immediate supervisor or human resources. He went to his immediate supervisor. Now, the or was in Steele's policy. Here's a situation where the court's findings literally are that Cirrus complied with each of the policies, and then as an ultimate finding in respect to the affirmative defense, that he complied with none. Now, in terms of the... So when Mr. Bauman just now said it never happened, i.e. that Cirrus never obeyed or complied with the policy, what he's saying is, he took the first part of the disjunctive. He reported to his supervisor, even though the court below found that his supervisors were amongst the people who were creating this abuse, which the court found. Now, the court, again, I remind Your Honors, and I'm sure you recall, this is the if it ain't white, it ain't right case, which the court found supervisors adopted as a philosophy and that they would see to it that minorities would fail. This is a case where Mr. Bauman himself testified in the court below that he, and the court found in the second order, I think on page 19, that he himself found sexist graffiti. So I've got racist graffiti, sexist graffiti, national origin graffiti, known now to the human resources manager, and no investigation is done, and at one point the general manager, whom given the facts the court found to have existed, the laughing, the not taking it up, Mr. Bauman himself testified was guilty of dereliction of duty, and to the extent that he laughed at Cirrus, this is the general manager, the highest ranking individual in the plant, that given that he himself laughed at what happened, given that is being true, was asked of him as a hypothetical, that Mr. Bennett's conduct would itself have been a violation now of a hostile environment law. Now that was Mr. Bauman's testimony.
Admittedly, that in any event. Now, as far as the chalkboard, I mean, I think it's just atrocious. It's clear from Mr. Bennett's testimony, Judge Williams, this was not for, you know, this was not a suggestion box. This was put there in lieu of, so that they wouldn't have to keep painting over.
What about these witnesses that Mr. Bauman says Mr. Siros did not suggest?
Well, when they did meet in the attorney's office, there was a long meeting. Mr. Bauman came to meet with him. My memory of the evidence, Your Honor, is that Mr. Siros testified that he gave him the names of those individuals, but I honestly don't recall.
It's in the testimony somewhere.
I believe it's in Mr. Siros' testimony. And Mr. Bauman's defense is always, well, that was 14 months later. Everybody was still employed at Steele at that time, so I don't know what difference that would have made. But, for instance, Mr. Siros had a work partner who testified at trial. Now, why wasn't he talked to? Siros didn't need to tell Mr. Bauman who he worked with, who his shift partner was. I see that my time is up. We would respectfully request a reversal and entry of judgment in our favor.
The case will be taken under advisement.